Welcome to the Performance Health Podcast. My name is Tim Caron. Today, Corey and I are going to be talking about small versus large group and how that's going to have an impact on your facility and the design you set up. This whole entire season has been really geared around not only just building out the dream facility, but enhancing and improving your facility. I had a great discussion with Coach Mike Boyle on assembly line versus rack-based, and hopefully this is building up some thoughts in your head that are going to allow you to build that facility to be congruent with the skill and the knowledge for your staff and hopefully your athletes to get the best training experience possible. If you like what you're hearing, head over to phpodcast.com. We got a coaching membership. We got a collective membership. We got a foundations course. We got a strength deficit course. We have a ton of great resources for you to dive into to enhance your knowledge. And my whole goal with all of this is providing really high level solutions for all strength conditioning professionals. Thank you guys. Please like and subscribe, share, helps out a ton. Let's talk about small versus large group facility design.
Today we're talking more group-based training and more private or one-on-one type training, and tying that into how our facility is organized. You've been in situations where you're doing both, so weigh us out with the differences real quick.
It's a pretty substantial difference when you're looking at organizing your weight room if you're doing predominantly one-on-one versus group. And one of the things that you see in terms of group-based training is either this mantra of, hey, we got to do like a open floor plan and we got to have a lot of open space to move and do our workout. And then you see another approach of, okay, box gym with a lot of people using singular pieces of equipment, and they're evolving in a lot of ways to have more group fitness areas and group fitness classes, whether they have a plan on that or not. And then you look at, all right, there's a team environment. And one of the things that is so interesting for me is this idea that like group exercise and having singular stations or having like open floor plan or whatever the dynamic in the private fitness spaces or commercial fitness is, how little they actually concern themselves with probably the best in the world in terms of organizing groups and in terms of team training environments. And it's such a funny nuance that you're like, wow. The expectation that if you're opening up a facility that you're going to follow their model, which it's like you should have taken a little bit more of an interest in the profession in general and realizing that we've worked through some of these problems of a long time ago and having a single station model or having a bunch of machines and trying to figure out how to cobble together a workout with a large group is like the next steps. And it's a lot of ways extremely antiquated in that you see these bottlenecks and logistic problems that you're like, these are avoidable. Like they've just been work through. And we talked about a lot in terms of last episode, in terms of assembly line versus rack based, or having a station that you're having 3 to 4 people congregate at and say in that central hub. But the commercial space, looking at such a group or large group, it's a shit show. And for better or worse, it is what it is. But if we're looking at that in terms of designing a facility, and we'll go through some of the bottlenecks we see a lot with the way a lot of group exercise designed. And then we look at the next level of private training facilities that just exclusively do personal training and or one-on-one or at high level, maybe a 1-to-3 coach to athlete ratio or a small semi-private kind of environment. The equipment changes quite a bit. Then you start to get into this, maybe a little bit more of a digression away from rack-based and start to incorporate more machines or single unit pieces that can only do one thing or one function. And we start to break down, what is that from a floor plan perspective? And one of the classic NSCA, National Strength and Conditioning Association, will break down of distance between training stations, like 8 feet between racks, or looking at 8 feet between platforms, or having 4 feet in front of a platform. These kind of like standard spacing things that we need to accommodate with large groups to having 4 people in an area and 4 people in another area, or these pods that it's not really that necessary with doing one-on-one, right? You can have 1 foot of space clearance as long as you can walk through with a leg press and a leg extension next to each other as a personal trainer. And you find it's less about where you feel comfortable. Maybe you want to have a little bit of eyesight and have a good angle or a good way to manipulate the weight or the mechanical advantage or disadvantage, et cetera, or just having a good opportunity to motivate and encourage. But the truth is, it's less about the spacing or the managing of flow and ingress egress, mostly just having these tools that are going to basically check a box that are going to accommodate some other folks. And then the reason why we need a machine versus predominantly free weight. And there's a lot of variables, and it's such a funny time period too, because you see so much perspective that's misguided or limited by anecdotal. And you just see this, oh, if you don't have this piece of equipment, you can't do a great job or you can't develop. Well, that's not true. It might be a good tool in a situation, but it's a classic hammer and nail situation where everyone associates success with one single piece and divulges a program that, quite frankly, is not really universally true. And you can get away with not having machines. You just, if you can have them and you know that you're going to use them, you should at least explore that option.
So you mentioned the big box gyms not really knowing what to do with like their group training space. At Allegiant, you went the other way when you started a group and then siphoned into more private. How do you guys organize it to make sure that one doesn't interfere with the other?
Yeah, segregated spaces or a siloed off space is best way to do it. And the way I think about both programs is with our group-based exercise, we start with the training split that we're going to do. So go back a couple seasons and go through training splits and frequency. And we're going to utilize the total body training program with our group exercise. And that's going to fall into a push, pull, hinge, and squat. Those are our big four. We're going to do some variation of that. And the breaking down of like a push, an upper body push is going to be vertical, horizontal. Upper body pull is going to be vertical and horizontal as well. And we look at a lower body push. It's going to be a bilateral and unilateral, whether it's a split stance or single leg stance. And then we look at a lower body pull. It's going to be hip dominant or knee dominant. And we're just going to break it up into those kind of eight big classifications of movements. We might vary angle. We might vary dumbbell or barbell. We might utilize a kettlebell or med ball. But the point being is it's going to fall into those filters of push, pull, hinge, and squat with those two subcategories of each. So if I look at a three-day total body program with up to 18 people, I need to make sure that I have enough equipment through barbells, dumbbells, kettlebells, and med balls and the stations we need to work out of to accommodate doing a push, pull, hinge, and squat for 18 people in a given hour time frame and 3 to 4 days a week. Now, with that being said, is that doesn't fall into the same category for personal training, where we find a lot more nuance and individuality. And we think about it from the difference between personal training and group training is, in the metaphor I use for everyone, it's, okay, we're in Hoboken, New Jersey. We're trying to get to New York City. We could take a train that's going to stop and start and have people come on and off, or you could take an Uber. One's going to be more expensive, but it's going to get you directly there. We're not stopping until we get to New York City versus the train, you're stopping multiple times. And with group, you're paying less, but you're working with other people and doing a centralized program. We'll modify if needed, but the hope is that we're on the train and we don't need to accommodate too much. Versus we're taking an Uber. We're trying to get there as quickly as possible in the most direct path as possible or in the most scenic path as possible. And that could break down into, instead of a 3-day total body, maybe we need to do a 4-day upper lower split, or maybe we need to do a 5-day body part split, or maybe we need to do a 2-day total body, but include more specific work for you based off of a body composition or body mass call. And with that being said, is there certain tools that are just going to be more unique and specific to a certain outcome? So if I need to work on some sort of body composition, certain cardiovascular tools or stationary cardiovascular pieces will be helpful. Or even some isolating based machine-based stuff where we can really hammer volume or density and create localized tension or changes in terms of the architecture of a specific muscle group, relatively speaking, to others, and doing it in a way that's not going to crush or dampen CNS or the central nervous system. And when we look at like those like split places, like the group is trying to accommodate a 3-day total body push, pull, hinge, and squat with the two subcategories for 18 people at a given time, versus on the other end, private training is what is going to be the necessary tools to help this person get to a specific outcome of body composition, body mass, and sometimes even performance or just feeling better.
You mentioned the NSCA recommendations. Have you found that specific square footage guidelines are better for like group-based or for even that private training space?
Yeah, there's good ratios to kind of work off of, but traditionally speaking, if you're looking at it from a like square footage per person ratio, it's probably like 100 square feet per person kind of thing. That's like a good way to think about from a group perspective. But there's so much like that goes into that, right? You look at it from, if I'm going to do if I have a full rack, I can do some stuff in the rack, but then we start to talk about some stuff in front of the rack, like Olympic lifts or plyometric work or even trap bar. And the way trap bars are operating now, most of us have some sort of bumpers, which have a thicker like diameter and or a width, and that's going to take up more space on the bar sleeve. And those, now trap bars are massive. So from a utilization standpoint, we want an 8-foot platform, because that's usually the traditional width of an Olympic bar, which is now the same width of a trap bar. We want 4 feet in between, and then we want 4 feet on either side and or in front of it. And so we need some space for our other clients that aren't doing anything to hang out, congregate. Then you look at other stuff like landmines, if you want to use that. Maybe you're doing pull-ups in the rack. Maybe you're going to pull-ups on the outside of the rack. There's all sorts of little like nuance and idiosyncratic things that you're like, it's not as like uniform. And then there's always columns. There's always weird angles. There's always something that you got to be creative with finding a solution. If you can really like hone in on, hey, I want to work with groups of 12. Okay, you should have about 1,200 square feet. I want to work with groups of 18. You should have about 1,800 square feet. And it's not a like universal truth. I've seen much more rooms with more people and work about 1-to-50 square foot ratio. I think it's personally too tight. And I think that limits the number of barbell movements that you could possibly do, because there's just a lot of barbells moving and they have two ends of it and they have plates and there's people paying attention, people not paying attention. So the less things have like at height and looking around, like to accommodate Murphy's Law, I think the better. The other end of it, we talked about this before, is this kind of rule of three, that if you look at supplemental pieces of equipment, you should have at least one piece for every three racks. So that means 9 people can work in on these one supplemental piece, like a glute ham or a lat pull down, or a, let's just say from, let's say you're really into it, but like a belt squat, something like that to accommodate that. And the way some of these like 1-to-3 kind of ratios work out is you're probably doing it at worst, a superset, at best, probably a tri-set or three exercises together. And what that does is creates this filtration system to not get everyone log jammed at that one singular piece. And that sets up nicely for, we can get good work to rest ratio. We're not hemorrhaging time from people standing around waiting for a piece of equipment to come open, but also too, it's, we can get really good weight and challenge people in a way that helps them get a good work, but also not necessarily blinding them with like ton of rest. Now, with that being said, in private training, that kind of gets thrown out. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, I've seen some private training facilities that you have to like angle sideways. So the pieces of equipment become the monopolizing aspect of a facility design, where a group, it's space, it's having enough equipment to check those boxes that you're going to do from your primary programming, versus in the other end, you look at it from a private training, it's not as necessary to have a ton of that 100 square foot per person ratio. It's about having all the tools to be able to get the job that you need to get done, and falls into big cumbersome machines like leg presses, leg extensions, lat pull downs, belt squats, leg curls, et cetera, et cetera. And the things that are hard to do from a free weight compound multi-joint lift become more necessary, because there's usually an underlying reason as to why someone needs to do private training or prefers to do private training, because they struggle with a very generalist program, whether it's not specific enough or they have very specific needs, meaning that they're not going to be as good proprioceptively or as biomechanically, where they can get the most from these compound closed kinetic chain exercises. So having a leg extension for someone that struggles with squatting mechanics helps. Having a leg press for someone who struggles with squatting mechanics helps. Having a leg curl for someone that can't do a Nordic helps. Having a lat pull down for someone that can't do a pull up helps. And it just means that, okay, we're probably going to fall into that like traditional, hey, upper lower, could do that push pull, hinge and squat, just broken up differently, or total body, however it breaks down. But as we start to think about the nuance that they need to apply for private training, is that they maybe have some sort of biomechanical limitation, or maybe they have some sort of psychological limitation, and motivating someone to push through on a leg extension, quite frankly, is just easier and probably safer than someone doing a back squat, for instance. And they could push through, but in a group environment, hopefully you can manage that room to protect people. And then one-on-one, it's going to be a lot more obvious that this isn't working the way I want from a biomechanic perspective, whether it's a range of motion loss or positional loss. And it's just, this is not going to get me to the outcome I want. I'd rather just put them on a pendulum squat, a belt squat, a leg press, et cetera. I just have them push through that really hard threshold port of that set. They're like, now these are real money reps and now you can't quit. Like, I'm going to drive you through. I might get some forced reps in there. I might get some stuff there because it's just going to fast track the process. And if I got 2 days and I can get a lot more value from each individual set by doing using machine to get them to the outcome. But the ratio space to that, back to your original question, is a lot different. And I'm thinking about like, all right, I just need to have I'm almost thinking like I'm a craftsman. I want to have every tool at my disposal to really do the job for personal training versus group. It's just, all right, what is the necessary amount of space I need to do? And you see this a lot with, they just missed the boat on this convergence of large group and very poor ratio of things like glute hams or rowers or rigs or barbells. Like, you see it, they have 50 barbells, so everyone can have their own little pod, and they have three rowers or one glute ham. And like, all right, the Metcon today has this. And that's a classic misunderstanding of having too much diversity and too many options, and you're going to have to limit your programming based off of the scale or the number that you have. And it's going to create bottlenecks. It's going to create, are you going to do a variation of the workout, but these other people are going to do this workout? And then it creates maybe some discrepancy between the experience, et cetera, et cetera. If you could do group, you need to make sure everyone has at least enough availability on that. And I'll make this note too, because we're going to be candid about the critiques I get about the facility design I have. And one of the biggest points of feedback is, and if any one of my clients listens to this, I hope you hear this, we don't have enough lighter dumbbells. That is the point. We do progressive resistance, that we do not have enough lighter dumbbells because we are encouraging you and incentivizing you to go heavier. The heavier dumbbells are available. So if you look at what we're trying to do psychologically, I'm trying to encourage you to use heavier dumbbells. And if you want more value from the things that you're doing, you got to be willing to be under more discomfort. And that comes with maybe psychological tricks around not having enough smaller, lighter weight things, because smaller, lighter weight things are in some context not as effective as larger, bigger things. And that's the problem when we look at group exercise. It's the association with the trend of comedy, wants versus needs. And you have I want to gain muscle, I want to lose fat, I want to look better kind of goal or outcome. And I'm going to do it with a group exercise, and I'm going to try to do it with 18 other people with one coach and doing a general program, a push, pull, hinge, and squat with progressive overload. It's still going to be well thought out and very well designed. But the truth is the real secret sauce behind that is you intrinsically motivating yourself to do things. But there is no option to go lighter. Then you only have one option left, to go heavier. And that is the choice I'm forcing you to make. It's choosing the harder right over the easier wrong, if we're going to quote our West Point friends. And that point too is something that as people work through in group exercise, I don't have a bottleneck there. What I do is have an opportunity. Like, it's different than having one glued ham and a group of 100 people and having GHD sit-ups versus not having enough 7.5 kilo dumbbells. I have plenty of 30 kilo dumbbells, so go grab those. Like, it's time to use some weight that's actually going to make a difference.
Dumbbells also follows the rule 3. So if I have 12 racks, I would need, what is that, 4 sets of dumbbells?
So it's a good question.
Close. We write from RVMs at our dumbbells all the time.
Yeah. So, all right. So this would be the answer there is having an adjustable set at every rack. I just don't think they're that terrible. I don't think
they're that situation.
Yeah. That's usually the way like most of the stuff is answered. I just like the wear and tear of group exercise is immense, and having durable things that you're not eating your cost every single quarter because you have to replace and repair things, like that makes a big difference. But yeah, if you're, and it's such a hard thing to answer, because as you look through it, like not everything is going to have the same level of strength. So I'm not saying we'll do this, but like a challenging exercise, like to row. And with that being said, you get into this like setup of like, you're not going to be able to use a lot of weight with that because you're very unstable and very unbalanced. Versus, like, hey, I'm going to get you in a very fixed position. You're going to do one hand on a bench, 2 feet in the ground, 3-point stance, and really lock in. Maybe you'll utilize a centration type of strategy, like a rotation or like a corkscrew of that shoulder, where you can use a much heavier weight. And then you look at it from not only that, I can toggle the difficulty of the exercise, I can toggle the total time of retention. So longer time of retentions, or I can do different angles, I can do different types of sets and reps. There's all sorts of variables I can do there. And especially if I look at it from the other level, let's say that I'm doing a very taxing exercise that precedes it, and it's in a pairing or a tri-set. So I'm doing heels elevated front squat like five sets of 12 and I'm doing five sets of 12 dumbbell row, like you might have a great capacity to use a very heavy weight. The truth is you're probably just trying to use that as recovery. And hopefully people are trying to grab as heavy weight as possible. But the truth is we all know how it works out and we've done field workouts ourselves. Like that's human nature. And you got a couple of bullets in the chamber when you're working with group exercise. And we want to start with the things that are going to be the highest risk and the most value, but we also want to make our way to eventually to that. And we're usually hit like in a reactionary sense. Hey, we don't have enough lighter dumbbells. That seems like a you problem. That's the way I would respond to that. But they always get upset about that. And it's not, trust me, it's not a facility problem. It's something that you need to work through yourself and take some initiative here and grab a heavier weight. Now, with that being said, not a bad idea to go, okay, if I'm going to have 18 people in a given class, probably need 18 times three. So what's that, 48 sets of dumbbells? Like, that's probably a good way to think about it.
I wonder, what other major bottlenecks or areas that people just miss the mark in group and even private training that we should be addressing and thinking of as we plan?
I think the first thing in group is you can't write a perfect program for everyone. You can just be good with execution. So with group, it's less about the equipment, more about what can you be successful with. In coach to athlete ratio, the level of the clientele you're working with makes a big difference. So if I have inexperienced coaches and I have older, less capable clientele, then the execution is going to go into this. I need to pick exercises you can't screw up, right? Like I'm going to do goblet squat over a heels elevated back squat. I'm going to do a foam roll leg curl over a snatch grip deficit deadlift. Like I'm just going to be like, all right, there are these exercises they can push really hard, challenge themselves to do really at a high level, but I'm going to focus on what is the minimum viable product that I can put out there for these people to be successful with and fall into our principles of training. Because when we look at it from this notion, and this is something I think quite a bit about, is this idea of the only truth is we need principles no matter what, right? If I'm doing one-on-one versus a large group, I need to abide by principles. And just to review the principles, there's individuality, specificity, progressive overload, progression, reversibility, and diminishing returns. So the big six. And you got to think about that with every single aspect of training you do. And you're looking at it from individuality in a group environment. Okay, I'm trying to accommodate biomechanic and physiological things, right? Do I have a countermeasure to them not be able to do a certain exercise, yes or no? And do I have a certain countermeasure to someone not being able to either progressively overload at the rate that they should, or maybe not recover adequately? So there's individuality. Then we look at from a specificity standpoint, most of our goals are going to be bucketed into looking better and feeling better. So looking better is either losing fat or building muscle. So all the time I'm working accumulation intensification to keep raising the ceiling and keep hammering that primary goal, building muscle, burning fat. That is specific to our needs. Then we look at progressive overload. I got my three forms of progressive overload, intensity. I'm trying to go up in weight. I go up in volume where they can add reps, sets, or total time under tension. And then I can look at density where I'm trying to either do the same work in a shorter period of time or more work in the same time. And then we look at the next level of progression. Do I have some sort of thing from one training block to the next that allows for people to develop the motor patterns or the things that are necessary towards that goal, right? So going from a goblet squat to a kettlebell front squat to a back squat kind of thing. Then we look at the final levels of reversibility, like you use it or lose it. So you need to come a certain amount of times per week for a certain amount of weeks in a row to have the residual towards your goal. And if you don't accomplish that frequency or that goal, then you're not gonna be able to get that. And I think when we think about, hey, what is a sustainable frequency for a group exercise that's gonna have variance from intensity and intent from day to day, because just you're playing the law of averages there, that most people are gonna give 100% of the effort, maybe 10% of the time, versus majority of the time it falls into this kind of, all right, like I'm coming here for 2 weeks a year, I'm gonna give about maybe hopefully 70 to 90% effort. That's not bad. But with that being said, it's not maximal every time. So you're abiding by that. And you're looking at the residual from that. Okay, I'm probably gonna need 3-4 days a week to help a person increase their body count or decrease their body fat or increase their lean muscle mass. And then the final one would be diminishing returns. And diminishing returns is a reaction to their not progressively overloaded at a rate that we think is sufficient. So if they can't go up in weight, I gotta go down in weight. If they can't do the certain volume that I'm asked to do, I gotta go down in volume, whether I drop a set or I cut reps. And if I can't do it in a certain density, I need to rest longer or I need to cut certain things out of the actual workout to accommodate rest organically. And we look at all those six principles. When I'm thinking about my program, I'm thinking I need to be able to execute on that. And I need to adjust my program and what I can be successful with a large group or a small group to be successful with principles. Versus one-on-one, I am more cognizant and more aware of these principles and their shortcomings or their inability to be executed on with a lot more rapid response. So I'm working with you, Corey, one-on-one. You have a goal of gaining lean muscle mass, burning fat, and you slept 2 hours. I can immediately change that versus 18 people. There might be a delay. I might not see that till I get to my second or third set of my A series. And then I got to start to create contingencies in there. That's why I have velocity-based training. That's why we track stuff in our bridge or air fat, whatever I'm doing it with. But in one-on-one, I can just a lot more rapid. I can pivot quicker. I can go lighter. I can go longer rest. I can cut the exercise. I can modify that exercise. Today, we're going to have a good shitty day. I'm going to put you on the leg press. I just want you to go as hard as you possibly can instead of heels elevated front squat. That's the thing that's so different about those two. And the other idea is with one-on-one, we could be more creative on the onset. Like versus, hey, someone's hopping into group exercise. They're jumping into a program that's already been running. I'm customizing this program from the beginning. So I'm probably going, or Corey's probably not going to respond well to doing heels elevated front squats. I'm just going to go straight to the pendulum squat. So I can start that up. But that's not necessarily possible with group exercise because the more exercises we're coaching at once, the less effective we are. And if I'm in one-on-one, I'm only coaching one exercise at a given time, no matter what, versus a large group. If I'm coaching 18 people and they're all doing 18 exercises, that's going to be a problem. And that's going to be an issue. And the same cues that I would use for front squat universally, like elbows up. I want to keep your elbows parallel to the ground as you're squatting down, eyes on a fixed point straight ahead, knees aligned over the ankles, making sure you're getting hamstring down to calf every single rep. As you're coming out of the bottom, you want to lead with the elbows. Like those are cues that I can use and hit 18 people simultaneously. Versus one-on-one, I Corey struggling with elbow position. Like, all right, I'm going to maybe adjust his rack. I'm going to adjust his feet. I'm going to go a little bit lighter. I'm going to work on this individually. And I might give him some tactile feedback where I can't do that with the group. I can't give tactile feedback to 18 people simultaneously.
Right.
It's going to be yelling and it's going to be a lot of managing. And the less modifications or variation I have going on at once, the more successful I can be. And I think that's the part where we look at group exercise. It's not compromising the value of your program. It's just being realistic with what you can be successful with to accommodate principles of training. Because that's a universal truth. They're context independent. That if you don't have principles, your program is shit. And if I can't be successful with the program that I'm writing, then I need to write a more successful program that can be more successful and starting there.
So now, because I know you love these types of questions, would you rather design a facility strictly for one-on-one or strictly for group training?
You want me to be real about this one and honest?
We got to keep it real.
I want to design a facility that makes money.
Yeah, all right.
Because I want to be able to feed my family and I want to be able to stay open. I think that's something that's often misunderstood.
It's absolutely something that needs to be considered.
No doubt. And the intentions and doing things for altruistic reasons is all well and good, but we work in a commercial business and it's a capitalistic society that we need to be able to accommodate. And I want to have as effective as a program as possible and having every piece of equipment. And I want to have contingency measures, which if anyone looks at, hey, why I use functional movement screening, because it holds me accountable to the exercises that I'm doing redundantly. The thing that people often forget so much, whether it's working one-on-one, working in a group environment, working in an athletic environment, doesn't matter, is that we're going to do things redundantly, push the threshold. And if there's underlying biomechanical issues, that's going to lead to a compounding effect negatively. And if we look at FMS or any movement appraisal, it's this idea to say, okay, the understanding and the realization that I'm going to push things redundantly to threshold, squat, hinge, push, and pull, getting to a certain level of intensity or volume or time or tension, that's going to be stressful. And that's going to lead to a reaction of sort, right? From a physiological, biomechanical. And most people don't like that feeling. So they're either going to try to accommodate some aspect of it by shifting the range of motion, maybe becoming more asymmetrical, just exacerbating some underlying issue. What becomes more transparent under threshold will be the leading cause of why someone gets hurt or doesn't get to the outcome that they want. So an appraisal with functional movement screen becomes more and more necessary when you realize that I'm working at a scale that is doing things redundantly to threshold with a large number of people. And as I start to think about that, I need that point of contention to say, okay, you're doing a good job. People are moving with no asymmetry and through a full range of motion without pain. Like those are really good things to at least rule out. And if that's any value there, it's just to hold you accountable for as you go through this process of scale. Now, on the other end, you need to maybe look at some objectivity stuff and looking at some of the vaults we in terms of ForceTech, Nordboard, Dynamo, ForceFrame, et cetera, et cetera. And as I start to break down, like, all right, my program is X, my program is trying to accomplish this, I need to make sure that I'm having accountability built in. So I'm doing the best job I could possibly do, no matter what. But it goes in that level of, okay, I want to have people coming in, having great experience, getting great results and paying. And if they're getting great experience and they're getting great results, they're going to continue to pay. And it doesn't matter like what anything else other than that, because that's your job. You're servicing them to get some outcome. Like if I bring my car to the auto body shop because it's broken and it's not fixed, and therefore I'm going to be upset about that. Same thing. They're coming to you because they can't or won't. They can't do something, meaning they have some sort of biomechanical, physiological restriction, or they won't do something. It's some sort of psychological block. That's where you insert yourself and you have some series of accountability to build into there. But in terms of what is better, like I would love all the toys, but if they're unnecessary, if it's just burning cash and it's going to lead into my bottom line of breaking out of this overhead and then subsequently an operating budget, yeah, but that's also the difference of you got to be realistic about that. And it's nice to have, not a need to have. Okay, you should be really thinking about that. Can you do it without it? And can you get equal or comparable results with something else that's much cheaper, more sustainable?
That's a mic drop moment. So I appreciate your time, Tim.
Awesome. All right, my guy. Have a great rest of your day, man.